Welcome to the Alliance of Independent Authors Insights Interview, a monthly podcast for self-publishing writers and author publishers. You can join our organization at allianceindependentauthors.org. Here, each month, a key self-publishing figure is interviewed by Ally Director Orna Ross. So, let's see who's sharing insights with Orna this month.
Hello and good evening from London. I'm Orna Ross from the Alliance of Independent Authors and very pleased to be here this evening with Mr. Toby Mundy of Toby Mundy Associates, literary agent. Hi, Toby.
Hi, Orna. How are you?
I'm very well. And we are here for the final Ally Insights seminar, of the year. But this is a kind of a special event this evening, because we're not only going to be talking about subsidiary rights and what they mean for authors and how writers license rights and sell rights in the new digital age, but we also have an exciting announcement to make about a particular service for Ally members. Isn't that right?
Absolutely. Absolutely. It's been a while coming, but I think we're on the right track now.
So let's just begin at the very beginning. Some writers listening to this conversation will start off not really understanding what publishing rights are. Indeed, some might say nobody ever understands fully what publishing rights are, but particularly how authors can actually take advantage of their intellectual property and get their work into different sort of formats and territories and more widely available to more people, which is really what it's all about. So can you talk to us a little bit? You tell us a bit about your own background. You were a publisher last year, I think, or 2 years ago, you decided to move into agenting. Just talk to us a little bit about becoming a literary agent, why you did it and what that's like.
So thank you. So I've been in publishing for 25 years. I spent, before that I was a teacher and a bit of an academic. I spent, how long did I spend? I spent about 7 years at HarperCollins working on the general list and then ultimately being responsible for an imprint called Fontana Press. I then spent 3 or 4 years at Orion working on the Weidenfeld and Nicholson imprint as editorial and then publishing director. And then at the end of 99, I was asked by some very nice Americans to set up a British office for them. And that, they were a company called Grove Atlantic, who were an independent publisher, by which I mean they were privately owned and they were published more in the sort of literary space, and they weren't owned by a large corporation. They asked me to set up a London office, which I did. And we traded, and they continued to trade as Atlantic Books. And I left Atlantic Books of my own volition a couple of years ago. There's some new owners came in and they were great, and I thought that was a good time to go. And I was able to execute a plan I've been turning over in my mind for a long time, which was to become an agent and to move into the representation space. And I started an agency called TMA, Toby Mundy Associates. I worked very closely with Ed Victor Limited, maybe more about that shortly. And we represent writers, and we represent some of speakers, and I also help brands like The Economist magazine and New Scientist magazine and one or two others to publish effectively in the book space. And it's worked really well. And although people would imagine if you work for a publishing company, you run a publishing company, you spend a lot of time working with writers. In fact, for the last 3 or 4 years I was running a publishing company, I didn't spend any time working with writers. I spent a lot of time working with accountants. So it's great to be working with writers again.
I was really struck by you saying that when I asked you how it was all going a while back, and you said, it's great, I'm actually talking to writers.
I missed it. I mean, that's the reason you start doing this thing.
Absolutely. And it is, I think, one of the funny things about trade publishing, and, you know, the bigger an entity gets, the further away sometimes we get from kind of what's core. But, so talk to us a little bit about rights, Toby. Speaking to the writer, as I said, who may not fully understand what we're talking about when we talk about publishing rights.
So rights are so in most good publishing agreements with traditional publishers, the copyright is retained by the author, as it should be. It's their work. But they licensed that copyright to a publishing company, and the word is literally they grant the right to produce versions of the book. So one version of one right that is granted is volume rights, which is the right to produce a print edition. Aligned to that in a traditional publishing contract now, unbreakably pretty much, is ebook rights as well, although, again, we can talk a little bit more about that in due course. Often that might include audiobook rights, so that's another right, that's another repurposing of the words into another format. And then there are a suite of other so-called subsidiary rights as well, which are derivatives from the original, the core work. And those derivative rights, those derived rights, might include film and television, or translation, which is the right to produce a version of the author's work in a language that's not their own. Or it could be the right to produce a different edition of that work in the United States. It could be merchandising rights, which is the right to produce a tea towel, or Lord knows what else, anything else, in fact. It could be comic strip rights, picturization rights, the rights to read on television or radio, a sort of radio for morning reading. Those are all repurposing of the original. Repurposing of the original work into something that is intensely closely related to the original work, the original text, but is something different. So that's what rights are, and there is a market for all of them, not at all times, in all places, and for all works, but for over the life of a book that begins to work, more and more of those rights will come into play. So obviously, J.K. Rowling famously was turned down by a lot of publishers. And over the course of her unprecedented success, almost all the rights you can imagine in her work have been exploited. And each one of those has produced for Joanne Rowling a revenue stream. And in many cases, a fairly enormous revenue stream, I should think.
Early, equally famously, decided to kind of self-publish a bit at the end, which is also interesting.
Absolutely. Very, very interesting. That's an example, isn't it, of self-publishing taking place when the author in question is a market maker, you know, like James Patterson, like one or two others. I mean, they're rare, rare birds, but extraordinarily interesting, I think, that she could do that.
Sure, and I'm sure we'll see more of it. And of course, rights are changing. You know, this space is a little different for self-publishing authors, or for authors who self-publish some titles, we should probably say, than with trade publishing. So conventionally, what happened was the print book originally was the core work that you were talking about. And from there, then subsidiary rights were, you know, most commonly translation, then perhaps film and TV and audio books. For the self-published writer, it starts generally speaking, and we are generalizing, which is all you can ever do with authors because it's always the exception. But generally speaking, we're starting with the ebook, and then print can be a subsidiary right. And we do have some members who have done that. Mm-hmm. And audiobooks are very often something that the writer will not want to sell as a subsidiary right, will prefer to keep themselves, because again, it's something that's relatively easy for people to do themselves. So, you know, our relationship in terms of Ally and why we kind of started the conversation with you some time ago, and then we decided to kind of go together, was because you seem to have a really good grasp of the potential of self-publishing in the right space. So can you talk to us a little bit about that?
Yeah, no, absolutely. I mean, to go back to your initial point, I think, you've really been very instrumental in educating me. I mean, it is heresy to those people in traditional publishing houses talk about print as a subsidiary right. And that's partly because all people are involved in some kind of land grab where they want to control as many rights as possible, and that involves taking things away from authors. But also because the old publishing companies, in their defense, are geared around a manufacturing model. I mean, they were built around a manufacturing process that involved lots of paper and so forth. Yes. So to answer the second half of your question, I think, I mean, the tectonic plates of the whole industry are obviously in play, and various there are various elements driving this, but there is no question that the definition of what publishing is and who or what a publisher is has changed irrevocably and profoundly, and produced a much more diversified, variegated ecosystem. That has been enabled by Amazon in many ways, who spent millions, maybe even billions, for all I know, on infrastructure and digital delivery channels. And it has allowed an enormous number of authors, some enormously talented, some perhaps less so, to enter the publishing space of their own accord and to experiment in that space. And this space, which I think of as micro-publishing for reasons that I'm happy to talk about further, is the most dynamic and interesting and sort of organic space in the whole industry. And it is coming into being at exactly the same moment when the giant conglomerates are also changing their models in very profound ways. So to develop that, perhaps, if you wish, a little more, it is an ecosystem. I mean, you know, there are ecological niches in which people can prosper. The big conglomerates in the English-speaking world, and most people now think of Penguin Random House as the biggest, these are becoming vast brand management systems. So what they're really good at doing is taking, I don't know, Zoella off YouTube and making her a best-selling novelist. They're very good at taking Dawn French, being a, you know, accomplished actor and comedian, and turning her into a novelist. They're very good at stuffing 400,000 copies of Jamie Oliver into the book trade. And they're not so good at anything that needs explaining or anything that needs to have a market made for itself. So you end up in a rather surreal position at the moment in the corporate publishing space, where the bosses of these companies, who are nice, good people, believe in books mostly, the bosses of these companies would rather spend £500,000, say, on the memoirs of a DJ who's got a lot of Twitter followers, than to spend £10,000 on a first novel by someone that no one's ever heard of. And they would view the £10,000 advance as a much riskier proposition, unbelievably, than the £500,000 on a DJ with however many, 200,000 Twitter followers and all the other stuff around that. And the reason why they would view it as less risky is because the DJ is a brand. You know, the brand is the promise of an experience, so the DJ is a brand. And the DJ comes with this channel, this ready-made audience, so the publishers themselves don't have to be market makers. There is a point to all this, by the way. At the same time, in the independent publishing space, by which I mean the independent authorship space, the micro-publishing space, there is this explosion of creativity and entrepreneurship, and people are becoming the best and most successful micro-publishers, self-published authors, are becoming extraordinary entrepreneurs and are able to make markets for their work, but not just make markets for their work in the which is the most difficult work to market of all in many ways. So it's quite easy to make a market for a memoir, a misery memoir, because it's quite an extreme story and you can alert tabloid newspapers and all that kind of stuff. It's very easy to make a market for a celebrity or a DJ or something because they already have public profile. The media is waiting to hear what they have to say, and they have these social media platforms. Very, very hard if no one knows who you are to make a market for your new crime novel or your new piece of romantic fiction. And anyone who can do that successfully is a kind of prodigy of some kind. And why all this matters is because in a universe where the giant traditional conglomerates are thinking about brand management, lots of the creative and lots of the innovation is going on in the self-published space. Now, it may be, and I've spoken partly through you and partly not through you, to authors who I suspect may never go back to the traditional publishing space, at least not until quite profound things change, because they are able to do so much better, and the frustrations of being published by traditional publishers just drove them crazy. And, you know, they love getting up in the morning and saying, well, what am I going to do to make my book sell today? Which is, frankly, that's not what happens in a traditional publishing company, which is more of a kind of conveyor belt where something passes and then goes quiet. And so as we've seen from the Martian, the Weir book, and from all the other works that we know, every now and again, the huge talents and works come out of this space. And also a whole raft behind those famous successes, a whole raft of really interesting and talented authors are doing really good work and astonishingly are working out some of the most difficult commercial problems in the industry for themselves and in alliance with you and with your members and in this collegiate space that represents self-publishing. And it is not just the English-speaking publishers, say Random House, Penguin Random House in the UK, who are interested in what's going on in this space. I think publishers all around the world are interested in what's going on around the space. And we are, I believe now that we are in a position where we could create a document along the lines that we've discussed and may discuss shortly, which could become a small but significant event in the global rights business, which will be read with interest by lots of people because it represents for them a 6-monthly snapshot of what's going on in this space, what's interesting, what's exciting, what's going on. And even if it doesn't produce for the authors who participate instant results, it's a long road and you're starting to see, you're starting to build and develop their reputations, tell stories about them and their work to people who are interested. And I mean, I can go on, but there is so much innovation and so much originality and so much talent in the best expressions of the self-publishing space that I think we can be confident that there is a lot of curiosity about what's going on there, and people want a map, not just people who work in Penguin Random House or at Hachette or God knows what else, although they would be interested in this document too, frankly, but also people who work in television and people who work in film and people who run German publishing houses or French publishing lists, France, very tricky in all rights markets, but nonetheless, or Holland or the United States or Spain or wherever. It would be received with immense interest, I think.
So that's what we're planning, folks, essentially, for our professional members. And there are criteria for sort of being considered for your, you know, having your book considered to be part of this document, which will be circulated at London Book Fair or in advance of London Book Fair and Frankfurt Book Fair each year, twice a year. For our professional members, essentially, we're looking at Toby representing those members or some of their books and taking them out there to interested rights buyers all over the world, essentially. Can you just elaborate a little bit, Toby, about the plans?
Yes. So it has taken you and I a while to get to this point, and part of me feels embarrassed about that, but actually, it's taken me this long to get up to speed and to work out something that's plausible and deliverable and doesn't mislead anybody and allows us to provide good service and to maximize the strengths of our proposition and minimize the weaknesses of it. By which I mean, it seems to me that there is such curiosity about what's happening in the self-published space. And as I say, that the people who are prospering in this space are extremely unusual and talented, because not only can they write, but they know how to do audience creation, and not just audience creation, but audience creation in the most difficult and competitive of genres. What I believe we should do is, as you say, Honor, is we should come up with a twice yearly rights guide, a document that looks good, looks great, doesn't contain covers because we don't want it. We don't want it to become too enormous to email around, and other rights guides don't include covers, but is formatted very neatly and very elegantly that we can send around to all the people who might be in the market to exploit the rights of this book. So that would include the leading publishers in all the leading territories, the scouts, who are the eyes and ears of lots and lots of different kinds of businesses, mostly publishers, but also television companies and film companies in London and New York, where there are eight, probably 10 of them in London and maybe more or less the same number in New York. And then also, as I say, connections in the TV and film industry and to the British publishing community as well as to the bookseller and to various other trade and industry publications. Because I think if we get this right, and we may not get it right exactly first time, but I think our plan is simple enough to deliver. What we're presenting essentially is a sort of state of the arts document. That is to say, it's a state of the nation document. So every 6 months, we're saying, here's where we are. Here's what's doing well in this space. Here's what's really interesting. And here's what's available. And it will, over time, become a better and more effective document. And over time, and that time may be one or two iterations of the document, or maybe it's three or four, I don't know. But over a relatively modest time horizon, it will become something that people start to look out for and people are interested in. And there will be huge interest in its contents from the get-go, I think, probably.
And we will be looking, you know, at probably not just in terms of creating this document, which is slightly different to anything else that's out there, you know, groundbreaking stuff, really, but also how the authors will be sold. So one of the reasons that Ali was really interested in working with you was your association with EVL, which I think is really funny, which we come to in a minute, but also your flexibility. Self-publishing authors hate exclusivity and don't understand exclusivity really and the need for it. So we put up with it when we have to. But you, I think, were stood out to me certainly in the agenting world as somebody who was willing to work on some books, but not all books necessarily, who would represent a self-publishing writer as somebody who is already successful, because very often we see our members who are, as you say, already doing amazing things being handed exactly the same contract as a writer who is completely unproven, has never sold a book, you know, essentially the basic contract. And so the understanding that self-publishing writers are different and will probably be looking for different kinds of deals, you know, will in the main want to hold their ebook rights and or certainly that they will be acknowledged, you know, as being not being your typical tiro writer who's just kind of setting out. Can you talk a bit about that?
Yeah. Well, thank you for a start. I think a little humility and pragmatism is probably in order where this is concerned. And I also think it's incumbent upon me to use whatever experience and connections I have and my colleagues have to help people come up with solutions to their creative and commercial challenges that are fit for purpose. So it is a dogma that ebook and pbook rights can't be separated for the UK publishing combined. They're not much going to break the line on that. And that's not ideal for most self-published authors. But of course, there are commercial terms. There are commercial propositions that people would consider, because everything in the end can be solved by commerce. Where international editions are concerned, I think probably participating members would need to accept that in a Spanish language deal, those rights would probably have to be aligned. Because it will be challenging enough to sell them without breaking those off. But again, I just think we all have to go forward in good faith with our eyes open and see what happens, and be prepared to be flexible. I think, you know, there are matters of principle at stake here, but there are also commercial things. That is to say, is the reluctance to part with ebook rights in the German language a matter of principle? Well, no, it's not. There is probably a sum of money and a publishing proposal that might easily change your mind. And the reason this becomes salient, I think, is because in the end, if you're succeeding in your career or in your part-time role, your part-time life as a writer, and things are going well for you, at some point or other, you're going to come up against a division of labor issue, which is to say, there are some things that I can do well, and there are some things at some point it makes sense for me to get other people to do for me, because they can do it well or better and they'll create enough value to pay for themselves. And I can spend more time doing the thing that's really, really blooming hard, which is writing good fiction. So at some point in everyone's, you know, if things are going well enough in your writing career to have a division of labor problem, this is a good problem to have. And it's at that moment that people like me can become quite useful, I think. So we are flexible, we are open-minded, and I think everyone who engages in this process has a will, I'm sure, take a similar view. And let's put stuff out there, let's put our best foot forward, and let's see what happens. I mean, so one could go on about that. The other thing about EVL.
Victor Limited.
When I started Toby Mundy Associates, I wanted to start as soon as possible. And the idea of starting the company was the idea of Ed Victor, who is one of the most distinguished agents in the Anglophone world. And he said, well, look, you like working with writers and you like doing these things. Why don't you become an agent? And I said, that sounds interesting. He said, yeah, why don't you use my back office? And I said, that sounds very interesting. So the idea essentially is that it's my own agency. I own the company, but I'm totally plugged into this company called Ed Victor Limited. They're based in Bedford Square in London. They have an extraordinary client list. Ed, you know, represents, I don't know, Frederick Forsyth and Jack Higgins and some of the giants of 70s paperback publishing, Douglas Adams, and then more latterly, I don't know, Nigella Lawson, Alistair Campbell, Matthew Paris, Keith Richards, Eric Clapton, U2. I mean, it's a very, very big client list. And he does it brilliantly, and he does it better than anybody else. He's been doing it for, he wouldn't thank me for saying this, but probably 50 years. And in that time, he has built the most stupendous back offices, contracts and finance and rights departments are brilliant, and they're used to working on exacting and high-profile authors, and they provide a sensational level of service. And I share what I earn. So my commission, I share it with Ed. And what it means is that my clients have access to a really good back office. I can look prospective clients in the eye and say, you know, Keith Richards doesn't have any problem with his VAT, and neither will you. It's allowed me to get up and running without... I could have spent 10 years trying to build a business, and at the end I'd have had something inferior to the one I stepped into in day one. So I'm very lucky, I think. And I also get to work with Ed, who's very good fun and rather wise about most publishing matters. So that's how we're set up.
That's fantastic. And I mean, that was really interesting to us as well, to feel that, you know, our members could get that sort of representation. Talk a little bit about the TV and film. I mean, that's where Ed Victor Limited comes in more or not? Am I, you know, talk a little bit about how it kind of works.
So Ed Victor Limited doesn't at the moment have a dedicated TV and film agent. But what we do have, and again, I come with some connections of my own, and then those connections have been augmented by working with Ed, is we have very good access to dedicated film and TV agents and direct access to film and TV producers. Not all of them, but a pretty good number. Lots of writers want to have this conversation. And the thing that I can't do is waste the time of these film and TV people. So it is often a source of some frustration that the work is not being presented exactly when the author thinks that they're ready to have it presented. The reason for that is because we don't get many shots at this, and we've got to get our story straight, and we've got to make sure we've got a really good story to tell, and the work that we're presenting is the right work and the work that we can sell. But we have wonderful connections. I mean, I was working with CAA in Hollywood on something a couple of weeks ago now, with a rather extraordinary film agent there who's partnering with me on this. Again, that person, that agent, is remunerated out of my commission. It doesn't affect my clients. But we have good connections with the producers and with the agents themselves. For the purposes of the discussion about the rights guide, I think what we would probably do, I think probably almost certainly, is send it ourselves directly to film and TV people. If any of them come back, then we would deploy specialist agents, because film contracts are like nothing anyone should ever, they're just beyond belief. That would be a happy problem to have. But I think we would probably go directly to film scouts and to some producers and TV people we know. Would it be a comprehensive list? No. Would it be a good list? Yeah, it would be a good list. And again, it's a list that would grow over time. And we want to be in a happy position where maybe in the third or fourth iteration of the guide, people are coming to us saying, please add us to the list. And indeed, one of the things we can do, perhaps, thinking about it, is to find a way for people to sign up to be recipients of it by saying who they are, but also declaring who they work for. So we know, it doesn't bother me particularly if an ordinary person who's just a standard book buyer sees this guide, but actually we should probably know everyone who gets it if we can.
Sounds good. Yeah, maybe have trackable, clickable links and so on. We'll talk about all the ways that might work. Yeah. So in terms of kind of what's hot right now, this is something that always comes up when people are talking about rights purchasing. Is there anything in particular, are there any particular genre that you're interested in? Or talk a little bit also about the guidelines, what you need in order for a writer to be a good story. You talk about the story of the writer, and actually when you started to use that term originally in our conversations, I didn't really understand what you were talking about. So yeah, explain story and then talk about the kind of story you need to be able to tell about a writer to interest rights buyers.
So the two poles around which the industry orbit, I think, are the original is one pole over here, and the proven is the other pole over here. Now, that which, you know, discussing originality is not a sort of philosophical concept about originality. It's kind of a new kind of story. So, you know, Bridget Jones' Diary was a new kind of story. Gone Girl was a, I mean, none of these, there's nothing new under the sun, but they represented a kind of originality. And then there's the proven, and certain kinds of story are proven. Certain kinds of story are proven, and certain authors are proven. And unless one can tell a story about the author or their work that involves one of those two ideas, it's very, very hard to publish or to sell or to market. And those two principles around the original and the proven are principles of publicity and PR, they're principles of marketing, and they're also principles of publishing, I would say. And in order to launch a product into the world successfully, and in this case we're talking about launching a product into the world successfully, would mean being able to attract the interest of a potential, let's just say, German publisher, we need to be able to tell a story about the author and their work that will attract their attention and help them imagine how they could successfully participate in the publication of the work. So in the self-publishing space, there are also lots of authors who are original, and there are a few authors who are proven as well. And by proven, I mean they've got a track record of some sort of success. Now, the context we're talking about the placing of foreign rights, let's take German publishing, for example. Now, German publishing is very vibrant and very effective, and there's some of the most brilliant publishers in the world. And it also has one of the most developed genre fiction markets anywhere in the world. They probably publish more million copy sellers per head of population than anywhere else in the world. Possible exception of China, maybe. The people who run those German publishing businesses obviously sit on millions and millions of euros of investment capital. They can allocate over here, or they can put it over here, or they can put it over here. They can invest wherever they like because they can buy everything that they want. They're not priced out of anything. So we need to be able to attract their attention. We need to be able to say to them, this is a work that can benefit from that can succeed with your investment. We can't guarantee that can happen, but we need to attract their attention. And so to do that, we've got to tell a story about the work. So what kind of story can we tell about the work that will add credibility to our guide, get their attention? So everybody wants proof of concept. They all want, as we said earlier, the people in the big conglomerates here, or indeed for that matter in Germany, aren't very good market makers. So what they want is people who've already made markets. So if somebody has had great success in the self-publishing space, that is a story that we can tell about the author and their work. And, you know, I can say a book is great, and you can say, Orna, a book is great, but how about, you know, 780 people on Amazon.de say it's great, or whatever, you know, that's the reader's report, that's the proof of concept. And so what kinds of stories about the authors and their work do we think potential licensing publishers overseas, and indeed people who work in television and film, what will they respond to? Well, alas, they won't respond to us saying, this book hasn't really done any business for anybody anywhere, because, you know, that doesn't represent any kind of story to tell. So we need to be able to say, we tell a story about the success of the work. And in the initial iterations of the guide, we have to set the bar quite high. There is a general reflexive rule of thumb among senior publishers in translation markets that if the book hasn't succeeded, in inverted commas, in its language of origin, it won't succeed in the translated edition. And that's not a bad rule of thumb in my experience. So I can think of very, very few examples where a book, as it were, tanked in English, but then went on to sell brilliantly in Spanish. So that's not a bad rule of thumb, and that's what publishers in non-English language territories also think. So we need to say this work has been a success, or this author has achieved success. And what sort of level of success will get their attention? Well, if you're a publishing director or an editorial director of a romance, crime, thriller list, for example, in the Hispanic world, probably we need to get their attention. What's going to get their attention? Well, it's probably something like 50,000 copies of sales as an average sale. What else would we need to say about them? Well, we need to say about the author or their work, that they're averaging a high hit rate. So we said maybe about 50,000 sales, that maybe we need to be able to say that their sales are still growing, or at least they're not shrinking. If the author was the author of standalone works, you know, not series books, but standalone thrillers or crime or romance, then probably we need to be able to cite quite high figures for those as well, 50, 60, 70,000 copies sold. And when I say sold, I mean paid for. Now, I know this raises issues about Kindle Unlimited, which we might come to in a minute, because otherwise my head might explode. But these are high numbers, and they're daunting numbers, and they're going to mean that some very good writers are, for the time being, not going to be able to straightforwardly participate in this project. But first of all, we're all learning as we go, and we're all going to go into this with an open mind. But secondly, 25 years of doing this has taught me that there's simply no point. This is the level, this is the kinds of stories we need to be able to tell about the authors and their work to get the attention of the people who have an unlimited amount of things to read and fairly, you know, who can buy any Anglophone project they want. So we've got this. This is why we've started off, I think, by proposing to set the bar quite high. And then as the thing unfolds, we get more market information and we begin to work out what our modalities are. Does that make any sense?
Yes, it does. And, you know, we have to start somewhere. Also, if some success happens, I think then people become more interested in what you're bringing, and you don't necessarily have to always be, you know, very, you know, the story can, I think, sometimes go beyond just pure numbers. But at the beginning, I think it makes sense for us to concentrate on numbers.
It certainly can. I mean, there may, you know, it absolutely can. But we will always need a data component in the way that we pitch a book. You know, publishers, and I would include self-published authors in that category, above all else want readers, and that they write in order to be read. And if they have been able to generate a substantial readership for themselves, that is a very attractive way of getting the attention of, let's say, publishers in the Italian language. No doubt about it.
Okay, that's great. So we're really excited about this, and, you know, being able to bring this service to our professional members, and, you know, just to get the ball rolling and to begin to see what is possible. I get the sense that, you know, the rights world is only beginning to really, outside the Anglophone world, as we call it, is, you know, just beginning to wake up to self-publishing. They're not as far ahead as, say, US and UK, but that catching up quickly. So it's going to be interesting times, I think, ahead, and it'll be a learning process for us all. And as always, we'll be feeding back and taking feedback from our very savvy authors and taking their suggestions too. So I think we leave it there for now, unless there's something else you want to tell people about.
No, I'm happy to be led by you. In this, as in all things, I find.
I like that sentence. I wish there were a few more people around here who would say that. Speaking from my home here. Okay, Toby, this is great. I should say that the deadline for the first issue of this guide is early January. So we're kind of saying to people to get their submissions in.
Should we talk about timing actually for a second?
Yes, do please.
So when we were talking about this, I thought every week that passes, I feel sort of happier with this decision. We agreed that we didn't want this document to be lost in the tsunami of documentation in circulation around the two big trade fairs in London and Frankfurt Book Fair. There is so much paper in circulation, so many emails, so many attachments, so many things not getting read, so many good books being passed over, that the last thing we need to do is introduce another 30-page document into this. And when I was talking to Ed Victor's rights team, and to you, Orna, as well, we thought, actually, well, goodness me, if we can get this thing out 6 or 8 weeks prior to the big trade fairs, then we can actually make a bit of a splash with it. We can get the attention of everybody who's potentially interested in it. And then at the trade fairs in London and Frankfurt, and also in our day-to-day business, we can develop some conversations. I mean, I think this is a good plan. I feel confident and pleased with it as a plan. And I think it allows us to do follow-up at book fairs rather than trying to harass bedraggled publishers and other potential partners from a standing start, you know, that have had this document. And if anyone I can think of in the industry who I know who received a document like this, as it were, in the middle of February, they'll all read it. They will all read it from cover to cover, which I think is what we want.
Absolutely. So we will be setting up a submission form in a while. Our tech person is not available in the immediate future. But if people just email me, orna@allianceindependentauthors.org, and I'll kind of take it from there and make sure that whoever can be in there and should be in there is in there. And we'll continue the conversation then as we go.
Absolutely. Well, I'm happy to come back at any time. I'd be happy to give a progress report. I mean, I think the key thing is we all go into this with our eyes open and we see what happens. And none of us quite know what's going to happen. But we also know that no one's ever done this before, which I find that kind of exciting.
Super exciting.
Good.
Welcome to Indie Author World. Okay, Toby, thanks so much for coming in to talk to us about it.
And thank you for having me. It's been great.
Yeah, and for representing our members indeed. And talk again soon. Take care.
So. Good night now. Thank you.
Good night. Good night, everyone. Bye.
Thank you for listening to the Alliance of Independent Authors Insights interview podcast. You can find out more author publishing advice tips and tools at Allies Self-Publishing Advice Center, www.selfpublishingadvice.org. For more information about being more creative, visit ornaross.com. Now, go write and publish.